This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book, coming to you from Tantalk Network's studio here in glorious Clearwater, Florida. It is a beautiful day here, and this is the place that everybody should be if they're writing a book, because it's just so great. It's so beautiful here. I am so thrilled today. I've got two wonderful, wonderful people on. At the bottom of the hour, I have a narrator. As you all know, I really have taken to Audible books, and one of my favorite narrators is Nicholas Guy Smith, who's been on a couple of times. And today I have somebody really, really amazing, and I'm sure that you've all seen him. His name is Robert Bathurst, and he was on Downton Abbey, and every British television show you probably have seen, he's in there somewhere. Anyway, he's at the bottom of the hour. But right now, I'm turning to somebody whose book I found so, so delightful. And so, I mean, it was like a book written for me. And I hope I pronounce her name right. Rebecca de Harlingu. Harlingu? Is that it? Rebecca, are you there?
Hi, I am here, Patsy. Yes, de Harling.
De Harling. Yeah, uh-huh. Why? Well, you know, I have to be very French now. De Harling. Without the all the things at the end, because... Because I don't know, I've mispronounced. Sometimes I try to be very French and pronounce it French, and sometimes I've had some names on lately that a German name that I actually made such a mishmash of. So repeat your name, because it is very pretty.
De Harling.
De Harling. Uh-huh. And if people will try to look at it with that spelling, they're not going to find you.
Oh, but nobody can ever say it correctly.
That's right. And it's a beautiful name. Is it your husband's name?
It is, yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay, so when you met him, you say, oh, darling, what a wonderful name.
Yeah.
Great. Oh, boy, oh, boy. What can I say about this book? It is so good, and it is so funny. It is just, it was written for me, because this is the kind of book that I like the most, and particularly during this period, these past few months, when I wanted to go to another place and another time. Wow. The name of the book is the, my goodness, I'm going crazy here. Don't tell me. The lines, I almost said the lives, it's the lines between us, the lines between us, because there are a lot of lines written here. There's also, I love books that have letters, that have diaries. Those are my favorite books, and they always have been. So, as I said, there's so many things in this book that I love. I'll let you set up the story, because it is just so clever. As a matter of fact, at the end, I mean, all the time I'm reading, I kept saying, well, is this her real family? Is this like a memoir? Which is a great compliment to you.
Thank you. Okay, so the book is about a young woman, 16, and she lives in Madrid in 1661, and something happens to her, and she must flee Madrid. She's afraid for her life, and her aunt goes in pursuit of her, but ultimately gives up the search. And then in 1992, a woman named Rachel in St. Louis, Missouri, whose mother has recently passed away, mentioning two people on her deathbed that Rachel has never heard of, finds some papers hidden in her mother's home. And the papers mention the two names that her mother had said on her deathbed. And, of course, the papers are related to the young girl who had fled Madrid 3 centuries before.
And so this leads us to a big, lots of fun, I can say. The discovery, the unraveling of the story. And yes. It's a device I love when somebody finds something. And I think it's delightful. I love it. And whether it's in a novel or a detective story, I love when they find something because I always want to find something. Oh gosh, I was just reading a story where they found a barrel and it happened to be full of gold coins. So it reminded me of your book too. This is so well done. Is it your first book?
No. It is, yes.
It's your first book? How?
Yes.
How did you write this book so perfectly?
Oh, thank you. I've done a lot of reading over the years.
Well, it does. Doesn't it come really from a lot of great reading?
It does, I think. It helps, yes.
I don't know how long it took you, but the writing is superb. And that's also shown by the fact that you got some really nice, important people saying nice things about you. That's for sure.
Oh, thank you.
And well-deserved, because it's already, it's won prizes. It's won...
It was a finalist in the International Book Awards, yes.
Yeah,
Best New Fiction category.
And which, has a first book. I mean, not a bad start, and I'm sure it's over the next while it's going to be winning more and more. And isn't it fun that at some point in your life, I opened this program for that Joy on Paper is a program for writers and those who dream of writing. And I love when somebody finally realizes their dream like you have.
Yes, well, it's been a long... I like to encourage anybody to stick with it. I had started my book in the 90s and got discouraged, gave up for about 20 years. And then after I retired, came back to it again and thought, maybe I should work on this some more. So they talk about setting your writing aside, but 20 years is too long.
A little bit, but you've got another 20 years that I'm sure we're going to have a lot of more great books coming out of you. So let's go back to this story. As I said, in my mind, it was like, this is real. She really found this. I sort of hoped you had, but actually it was somewhere deep in your mind, this idea. Tell us about the idea and of the idea of writing a story like that where you bring in, I like the period. And of course, I thought that was just perfect. And I needed to go back a little bit in time. I needed that. And so it was really great.
The tape right now is nice.
Oh, yeah. I mean.
Yes. I think the original kernel of the idea of the girl who, I don't know how much to give away, but...
Yeah, no, you don't want to give away too much, but I mean, we're talking over three centuries, and it's so fascinating, and of course, the opening, again, as I was reading the opening, now, I didn't know anything about you. I never, mm-hmm. when I get a book, I never look at the blurbs, I never look at what the publicists send me. I know that they work so hard
to
say
good things.
They work so hard to get it right, and they want to send me the stuff. And it's so funny. I never read it until after I've read the book because I don't want their opinion of it.
I
want that fresh opinion. I want I don't even look at the back cover. I don't look at your picture. I don't look at the little. I never look at anything. I just want that immediacy of when I start. And when I started this first chapter. And I'm thinking, this is so good. This is just so good. And it was so perfect. I thought, I don't think it probably, the first time she wrote it was that perfect, but maybe she's an absolute born genius, but you got it so perfectly. Tell us about that opening. How did you decide that was the opening and explain that opening?
It was, I am not one of these people who has everything planned out ahead of time. So it sort of grew from the idea of the story of the girl in Madrid And then I wanted to sort of, I love dual timeline books, so I wanted to have that connection with something more contemporary, and also to have somebody to sort of reflect on what was happening in the diaries. And so the beginning, I wanted to sort of warn the reader. I didn't want them to start off in 1661, and then all of a sudden, you know, a third or so of the way in, now they're in 1992. I wanted to write that first part to warn the reader that it's not going to stay in 1661. So I think that was how. And I wanted to be an element of surprise there and wanting to, you know, to get curiosity for the reader, like, well, why did her mother say these names on her deathbed when her daughter never heard of these names before? And that's how I just decided to make do that short prologue.
Well, I thought it was great. I thought it was just great. You know, as you said, you don't want to sort of tell the story, but tell us about some of the characters and how you develop them, because that we can, you know, without telling what's going to happen to them. Because it is, what I like about this book is it is a mystery. I mean, we really don't know what, you know, the story as we're getting into it. And I like that aspect of it. But tell us about some of the characters that you developed. You created them, or they're in your head. They were in your head, and they just started coming out there.
Anna is the aunt, who goes to look for the young woman who has disappeared. And I wanted her to be someone serious, and in the book, and you'll find this out, readers will find this out pretty quick in the second page, she finds a diary that her late husband had kept that she didn't know anything about. And so I wanted to start right away with showing how we keep secrets from each other, but then also how we try to leave something of ourselves behind. So I wanted to see her reaction to reading what her husband had left behind, and also to explore a little bit her loneliness and her widowhood and why her relationship with her niece is so important to her.
And you bring out here the topic of she's very capable of, in this case, we're talking about her medical knowledge, and that in those days, it wasn't expected.
It wasn't expected, and it was sort of a fluke that she learned what she knew from her husband, and is also reminding herself and others also. She makes no claim to particular expertise, but the people who are in need and know about her know that they can get help from her. The character of Juliana, the girl who leaves Madrid, is really from my interest in graduate school. I've studied Spanish language and literature, and there are a lot of plays in that period, and this is reflected in the book, where a man's honor is dependent on the women in his life to a great extent, and tragedy happens if for some reason he sees that honor besmirched. So I wanted to show that story from the girl's point of view. So that was kind of where I wanted, and what would happen to her, and what would her choices be. And of course, at that time and place, women's choices were very limited. And then Rachel, the modern woman, has a difficult relationship with her mother. She loves her mother, but she feels there's always something her mother is holding back. And when she finds the papers, she wonders if they're going to give her an answer to why her mother was like that. But at the same time, she's also angry with her mother, because why did her mother keep these papers a secret? So that's kind of the basic place that I started with for those three characters.
And so there, Rachel, who's a professor, she has that natural instinct to do research, and
yes.
so she jumps into it, that's for sure.
Yes, well, and you know, you're always asking your reader to have a willing suspension of disbelief. You're like, oh, it just so happens that she knows Spanish, and she's a Spanish literature professor, but
Well, it worked out. I mean, you needed that, and I think it was, as I said, once you get into this book, after the second page, you're into this book, and you believe anything that you write.
Okay.
So you keep saying, you know, Rebecca's a really great writer here.
It
does read so beautifully. Now, of course, you yourself had to do a lot of research.
I did, yes. I had some background, as I said, because I did the graduate work, but that was really more in literature, which I did want to bring in, and I did, as you know, bring into the book. And I think it's not that common for people to talk about the literature of the time in historical fiction. So I wanted to do that for sure. But then all the other things, yes, I had to do a lot of research about the daily life, because that's not really in the literature. And of course, when I started my research in the 90s, the internet was not widely available, so it was from books. And then when I picked it up again, for some things I felt like, oh, now the internet's here. Maybe I need to check that original research. So it was a blessing and a curse.
Yeah, well, it does make research so much easier. Oh, my goodness.
It does.
Having spent many, many hundreds of hours at the British Museum Library doing research, I mean, I'm so glad we didn't have internet in those days when I was doing the research. Otherwise, I wouldn't have spent those hours in that beautiful, beautiful room.
Yes, it's not a bad place to be.
No, it was, I don't know if you ever went there.
Yes.
That, you know, was the most gorgeous place in the world to sit and do research. You can do it much faster on the internet. And I think it's a fascinating from many points of view. I think having the story about how from Spain to Mexico City and then to Missouri, all of that you write so really so touchingly about in so many aspects that we really feel that we, you know, get to know the places and the characters.
Thank you.
Wow. You know, I'm always so thrilled when I get I want to say something special to She Writes Press, because She Writes Press, as you know, and they've worked with you on this book, but they certainly recognize talent when they see it. And tell us a little bit about that process of, I mean, you've written the book, waited 20 years or wrote the book. Finally, I'm sure your husband said, okay, fine. I see from the little thing you wrote about him that he's a pretty good guy.
Yes.
And he encouraged you. And
yes, it's been a long journey, and he was with me all the way.
That's right. And so he didn't get too upset if you didn't do the dishes or something. And let you write, because it was a lot of writing here. There's, you know, it's a big, big piece of work. So tell us, once you had it, at which point you contacted She Writes Press, and how did that go?
Well, I had met with Brooke Warner, who's the head of She Writes Press, a couple of times before I was even completely finished with the manuscript. And I'd met with her about building a platform and, you know, what do I need to do, a couple of times. But I still was going to try for traditional printing. As you probably know, She Writes Press is a hybrid press. And I queried a lot of agents, and I ultimately decided that I would go with She Writes Press. And because I had met with Brooke already, she had read a little bit of my manuscript, so she said, yes, they would take my book. And I'll have to say, I'm so happy that things worked out that way, because the community of She Writes authors is just incredibly supportive. And everyone I've dealt with at She Writes has just been so, not just professional, but just kind. And I really appreciate that a lot.
Well, they do. They really are encourage authors to follow their dream. And they work really hard. They on getting distribution, getting people out there. I know they're always on, you know, right there with when they have a great book coming out, they contact me. And I know when I take a She Writes Press book that I've got quality already. And that's important to me. You know, I get, of course, from all the big publishers, the big, you know, five, I guess it's still five. I don't know after this pandemic how many there'll be. Although they should be doing pretty well because people are reading, I think,
people
a lot.
People are reading, yeah.
But the fact that I know I'm going to get quality from She Writes Press really is important because I sort of will say, okay, I'm going to read that because getting, you know, books, you know, as I get at least 10 books a week, maybe some, one week I got 22 books.
Oh, wow.
that's a lot of books. it's funny because when, before I started this radio program, I would have bought 22 books and now I get them free. So it's really nice. So I was so thrilled when I got this book and I want to tell people about your website. I like that you have on there for book clubs. And I think that's very helpful. And I'm sure you'll do very well with book clubs. So tell us about your website and about the fact that you have questions there, discussion points, and that probably they can arrange a Zoom thing with you. So tell us about your website and how they find
so
it.
So if you can go to RebeccaDeHarling.com. And if you don't know how to spell it, you can look up my book, The Lines Between Us, on Amazon or any other site really that has books, and you can see the spelling. And yes, I have a section for book clubs. I have quite a few questions, possible discussion questions, that I would love to meet with book clubs over Zoom if you'd like, and I can even set it up. I'm all, I've gotten to be pretty, pretty
you're Zoom literate
Zoom
now.
Here. And I particularly feel comfortable with book clubs because I've belonged to a book club for over 30 years. So I know the dynamics of book clubs and the kinds of things they like to discuss. And actually, having been in a book club all that year sort of also was good for me as a writer because we did a lot. We did very serious discussions of the books that we talked about. And also I learned that not everybody likes the same thing. So that helps me as a writer if people say, oh, it's not really my cup of tea. I understand that. Not everybody likes the same books. So,
well, right now on your website, you have under book, you have one book. But I have a feeling that there's another book in the works, right?
I've started the research. I think it will probably just be straight historical fiction, not a dual timeline. And it's the same time period, almost exactly the same time period, but not in Madrid and Mexico City. It's going to be in Amsterdam. So it's completely different society. So there's a lot of research to be done there. And it's going to be about a woman who works in map making, which was very big in Amsterdam at that time, but of course would be an unusual position for a woman. So, yeah, there's a lot of research.
I want that book. That's my passion, map making. I love map making.
Don't you love old maps?
I love old maps. I have a trunk full of maps. I just love maps, and I spend half my kids, I homeschool my kids, I spend half the time making maps and hiding their things, their lessons. Instead of giving them a lesson plan, I'd hide the next thing they had to do somewhere on a map, and they had to find it. It was wonderful. My homeschooling, really, when I think of the homeschooling years, I think of it was all maps. We lived on maps. So, I'm looking forward to that book. You are a wonderful writer. I'm looking at your website right now, and your last name, and I will say that your husband has a beautiful last name. It looks so romantic. It's like the name for No, I'm not going to say bordello, but I mean, it's really.
Thank you.
I don't know. It's just got that vibe. Rebecca DeHarling, with a U-E at the end. Perfect. I think it'll be great. Anyway, you find this website and find this book. It's called The Lines Between Us. It's available wherever books are sold. Rebecca is fantastic, a brilliant author. Brilliant new author. She's just starting, and we've got a lot of books coming over the next few years. Okay, so thank you so much for joining me today, Rebecca. It was wonderful to talk to you.
Oh, thank you so much, Patsy. I really appreciate it.
Okay, have a joy-filled day, okay?
Thank you, you too.
Okay, bye-bye now.
Bye.
Okay, wonderful. We'll do some commercials, and then I'll be back, and I'm going to be back with somebody really fun. Oh, my goodness.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Have you ever faced disaster? The Red Cross is always there for you. The Red Cross responds to a call for help every 8 seconds. They have never turned anyone down. Now they need your financial support so that they can be ready to help you when the need arises. Donate online at redcross.org. Thank you.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more rewarding careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to Toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Hi, this is Patsy with a Z. And I am back, and I am so excited. Oh, boy, oh, boy. This is just going to be great. You know, I just love talking to authors. Now, and I talk to a lot of authors, but it's very funny that the two guys that who are narrators, and I mean really two guys, Nicholas Guy Smith and has been on the program many times, and he is one of the favorite of all of my listeners. I get more letters and emails about Nick. And then today, I've got Robert Guy Bathurst. Robert, hi, how are you?
Very well. What an act to follow. Nicholas Guy Smith, how can I follow that?
Well, oh, you do a pretty good job. You know Nick?
I don't. No. But I trail in his wake.
Oh well, you know he did. He's just wonderful. I've been going to sleep with him for years now.
Yeah.
Ever since A Gentleman in Moscow, he's the only other man I ever slept with, other than my husband, because he puts me to
sleep. Do share.
Yes. Yeah. So. Well, and you, wow, what's this with this middle name guy? It has some effect on you guys, turning you into major narrators, rich, famous.
I'm sure there must be another one, but yes, I like to think there's a connection, yes.
Yeah.
And my uncle Guy probably didn't realize that he was leading the way in literary things like that.
But
how lovely to talk to you. This is a joy on paper. That's a lovely title for a show.
Yes, it is. And it's so funny. I named the program Joy on Paper, and my sort of little thing is a program for writers and those who dream of writing. And it's funny that you know, I've talked to 500 authors since I started this program 5 years ago, and the one the person I got the most email for was for Nick, because I had him on. It was sort of a fluke. Nobody ever invites the narrator on of an Audible book. They, you know, they talk about the author. And but I loved his voice so much, I just had to have him on. And I thought, why not? And he was so surprised when I invited him. And I had Amor Tolls too, but I didn't really want to talk to him. I just wanted to talk to Nick. And then I got so many emails from people. They said, oh, he's brilliant. I want him back. And so I had to have him back and back. And so it's because really you have power as narrators when you get into people's heads. You've got power.
Well, that's awesome. Yes. And also the other unsung aspect of audiobooks is the director. Strangely, and the director, I managed to win it when we had the Audi Awards this year. I managed to make sure that the director was credited too, because so often in audiobooks the director doesn't get a credit, and the director is vital, because there you are as the narrator, just sort of the performer, it's sitting in your booth, and you need this other input, this other to bounce ideas off if there's lots of characters or any sort of nuance and stuff like that. So I had Lorelei King, and have done for the last six of these Gamesh books that I've been reading. And it's very much a partnership.
Well, of course, you are award-winning. I don't know what you've won so many awards. And I actually shouldn't be talking, because you're an award-winning. You were award-winning radio long before me. Long before me. So yeah. I'll let you do all the talking. Okay, how about that? Why don't you tell us... Tell us about this Louise Penny book. It's the 16th, a wonderful, wonderful series. I love the new book. It takes us away from the village, and explain about a little bit about her books and why you enjoy them. And then this new one, which is set in Paris and all the places that I have been. I have walked those streets. I lived in England. I lived in Sanning. I had a house in Sanning for many years.
Oh, did you? I know. Yes, yes, yes.
So,
yes, indeed. Sanning, which is has its own mystique, similar to Three Pines, perhaps. It's Louise Penny. She's written these books. She's 16. She writes one a year, and her main character is this man called Armand Gamache, who's set in Quebec State. There's this village called Three Pines, which he eventually settles in. And so there's a sort of a cast of characters. I have to say that the first 10 of the books were read by Ralph Cosham, who very sadly died. And so the last six of them, I got given the nod to take over from him, which was an additional pressure, because Ralph was very popular with the fans of the Gamache series. And so there was the pressure was on that would they accept another reader, which in very sad circumstances. And I adore reading them, because they're not just mystery thrillers in the sense of an Agatha Christie, and they're very much from the tradition of Christie. And in fact, she's won 7 Agatha Awards for Gamache books. But they have a sort of an odd, with a small M, mystical quality to them, an odd, sort of almost spiritual quality to them, in the sense that they are, on one level, they're a manifesto on how to live well in a cruel world, in amongst all the murder and mayhem and terror and all the things that go on, and the massive tension that arises even amongst the regular characters. You start to suspect them at certain stages as well. But in amongst that, there is underpinning it a rather sort of odd and different and strange sense of tolerance and forgiveness and compassion in amongst all the... And it does, what it does is, I think Louise gets across, is that she likes to say that goodness does exist. However terrible the circumstances might be, is that there is a sort of an essential goodness at bay, which brings most of brings the stories round, and adds a quality. Which, so they're not just process driven. They're not just police dramas of the standard sort. They are spiritual in that sense. They're also very sensual, because she writes a lot about food, and she writes about smells, and her writing is so vivid that you can almost smell it off the page. You can almost taste the delicious things that the people are eating. She has a wonderful sensual quality to her writing, as well as diamond sharp construction and twists and turns. And so her dramatic construction is great. Her research in police procedure is worn lightly. Ultimately, they're rattling good stories, but with this undertow of essential goodness beneath them.
And, you know, I love the one set in Quebec because I've been there many times, but the new book, the 16th book, tell us about the setup here is so much different from the village that we're, you know, accustomed to finding the stories. And one of, because it's modern day Paris, and I every time I think of Notre Dame, I sort of quiver just thinking about it. Tell us what it was like to read this particular book set there, and I'm sure you know Paris as you know very well too.
I know Paris pretty well, and Louise does, and she has a sort of strong personal memories of it. Which she drew on, as well as her doing her research trips there. So, there is a personally logical reason why Armand Gamache and his wife Reine-Marie find themselves in Paris. There's a family connection. Some of their family are now settled there. And, of course, things happen. Gamache, you don't want to stand too close to Gamache because, you know, something terrible is going to be happening fairly soon. Something terrible does happen. And it is incredibly exciting. As somebody who had to read, as a performer of this book, it had an additional exciting quality, which was that a lot of the characters are French. It's true that a lot of the characters in Three Pines, they're French Canada, but we find a way through that. But in France, when I was doing the French characters, you had to just choose. Oh, they're obviously speaking in English. But choose what timbre they were taking, and the most important thing is not to make all the French characters sound like Clouseau, and so that gave it an additional excitement as a performance.
And it, as you said, this story is particularly one of the characters that runs through the story is the godfather of and. In this story where he is hit, by a car, by a van. And that then takes us into this very complicated mystery that involves all parts of the family that, throughout the books, we've gotten to know them. We know what they've gone through. And particularly, I think there's Daniel and there's the different family members. So, in this book, she really just reveled in it. You know, it was there's a real spirit to this, and then I think that always can happen. You know, it was the right time for her to move out and just. I think we'll all look forward to going back to the village because this one is nonstop.
Yes, I think there are certain questions which it would be impertinent for me to surmise about Louise's connection with the characters. But yes, certainly Paris does represent for her a time when she had spent a lot of time with her late husband. And Inspector and Armand Gamache has qualities which Louise can probably illuminate about which she's drawing on in Gamache. And so it was a bit of a journey for her to set it in Paris. The various sort of resonances of her own life, which came through. But what she does in her fiction in Paris is to create a doubt in the motives of pretty well known characters. It's one of the family, Daniel, we haven't met too much before, but nonetheless, you start to doubt the character of. Certainly, Stephen Horowitz, the person who was hit by the van, the person we'd known from a previous book, and who's a godfather of one of the Gamache children, an old friend of Gamache, and of course there's a sort of a reputation that runs with him, which is unfounded or not, I won't give it away, about his role in the resistance during the Second World War, and the level of collaboration that went on in Paris at the time, which has been a muddy issue for so long and has been very distressing for so long. So that's all brought into it. And so there's an additional worldwide quality to it, which takes it away from Quebec and takes it away from the world of Three Pines.
Exactly.
But it's still the same characters who were rooting for and doubting in equal measure. And it leaves you very unsettled, and you really don't know where you're standing. The floor seems to be shifting as you're reading it.
Well, I think it's going to be a very successful book, and it's called All the Devils Are Here. Tell us where that title comes from.
All the Devils Are Here. Now you've stumped me. She does do a lot of references. I mean, she draws on C.S. Lewis and Milton and Ralph Waldo Emerson and Auden and Goethe.
And a little bit of Shakespeare.
There's all that. And so a bit of research. There is a reference to that.
It's on the tip of your tongue.
They're in the woods. It is on the tip of my tongue. They're in the woods. You can answer this, can you?
Yes. The Tempest.
You can. Hurrah!
The Tempest! The Tempest! Oh, the good! Tempest. I'm so happy.
Yes.
I'm so happy. I got a Cambridge guy. And, you know, the reason I moved to England when I was 21 years old, I moved to England when I was 21 years old. I bought a 400-year-old cottage in Sonning, which was absolute disaster. It had been left to rot away, practically, and I renovated it. But the reason I did is because in my mind, as a child, I wanted to go to Eton, and then I wanted to go to Cambridge or Oxford. I couldn't decide which one. So that's why I moved to England.
Really? Eton did something for you, didn't it?
Yes, it did. As a child, living in northern Michigan, where we had a four-room schoolhouse, in my reading, because I started reading when I was sort of like Beatrix Potter at the age of three, and I'm reading, you know, I'm reading so advanced, and I'm picking up books about England and set in England. And my favorite, of course, was Jane Austen. That's why I took Sonning, because it's not far, you know, from where she was born and where she was raised.
Yeah, yeah.
And
right.
But in my mind, that's where I wanted to be. I saw myself there. And so I just love, of course, that's... it's so great to talk to somebody from Cambridge. For me, that is like the ultimate in everything. Tell us about Cambridge.
I studied law, not English. you've got me on the quote, although I just called it up, and it is. It's Ariel saying, "The king's son Ferdinand, with hair upstaring, then like reeds, not hair, was the first man that leaped and cried, 'Hell is empty and all the devils are here.'"
Oh, good.
And,
I love it. I love it.
That's my spirit. And so, yes, it's a very, so that is the quote. And on one of those quizzes, yes, I got nul point for not knowing that.
Oh, hope you don't mind. You can remember me. You can say, because, you know, my name is Patsy with a Z.
Yes.
It's very unusual. So you'll know when you meet me, you'll say, "Oh, you're the one. I say, oh, I love it. I love it. I think you're terrific." Well,
Patsy with a Z, not Patsy with an S, because there's a song about that.
Not with a Z. We're not going to, please. I got this. This is, you know, in America, when I would tell people, you know, how to write my name, I'd say Patsy with a Z. Well, then I get to England, and Patsy with a Z. It's not the same thing, you know. So,
yes. Well, I find that with reading the Gamache series, I'm often being hauled up by the American director, Lorelei King, for saying things which are too Anglo. I mean, you know, it is essentially I'm using my own voice for the narration and other. But in the narration, I have to say certain words which would clash with an American ear. And so not only Z and Z and things like that, but there's so many of the others that are endlessly being tripped up on. But like cantaloupe melon, I said cantaloupe, and she said, "No, it's cantaloupe." And I said, L-O-U-P-E, Cantaloupe. And she said, no, Cantaloupe. And then so I said, what, as in Antelope? And she said, go to your room. So we have all sorts of things I get hold up on.
So why did you study law? You obviously have some other interests.
No, well, I didn't have any interest in law. I just wanted to do shows. And I knew there wasn't a drama course at Cambridge, so I knew that I wanted to do shows, and I wanted to go to Cambridge, and there were lots of things, endless opportunities to do shows there, and so I lied at my interview saying I wanted to be a barrister, a lawyer, an advocate, and I decided that at my law interview, if I'd said actually I want to have a career in film and television and theatre, they probably wouldn't have let me in, so I did my best acting job and lied my way through it.
Okay. You've played a barrister since. Have you had some really wonderful?
I only played a barrister once. I did. There was a very broad knockabout comedy called Mrs. Brown's Boys, and people will raise their eyebrows at that. But I played a barrister with Tourette in that.
Oh.
And so that was the only time I've ever played a lawyer.
But you got to wear the wig. You got to wear the wig. You got to look.
I got to wear the wig. Yeah, I did do a legal qualification when I finished. Actually, I was doing. Shows. I was doing shows when I came to London. I did another year of law after that, but I never had any intention of practicing.
Well, I think that's wonderful. What was it like at Cambridge? Was it? Tell us some funny story about Cambridge.
Well, to be immersed in. I mean, my college was the main court. The first court you come to was built in 1360, around 1400, around then. And so you're treading in you're paddling around in deep history. Henry VI did the chapel at King's. He also did the chapel at Eton that you're so fond of. What year was he? You're steeped in that. But it's also got an extraordinary sort of modern outlook. And they've moved with the times. But nonetheless, there is a sort of a deep and enjoyable tradition still at play there, but they have sort of moved on with it, which it's not all just a museum piece. And there's some really bright, interesting people.
And you come from a rather, very, very nice family background. Tell us about
it. I'm sort of standard bourgeois sort of lot, and I was born in Africa, grew up in Ireland, and my father was trained as a miner and an engineer. He was a mining engineer. Not that sort of smart at all.
Can you do an Irish accent? I like Irish accents. I think they're more.
Yeah,
I think they're sexier than French accents.
I do. I mean, having grown up in Ireland, I can manage one, and I do it. I do a poem about horse racing.
Oh, do that.
It's really about what trainers say, and the sort of nonsense that trainers say, the double speak that horse trainers say. And they always talk in a sort of double speak, which actually doesn't mean anything, but it shows that they're still very hopeful. And he goes things like, "We're very happy with our horse, serious contender, makes plenty of appeal, could play a big part, very hopeful, highly regarded, fancy to go well, looking in good order. He's been showing all the right signs at home. I'm expecting a big run. Hopeful, yes, very hopeful." And so it goes on like that. And so I love racing, and I got an article coming out in the magazine shortly about horse racing. And I love the Irish connection with it. And so the Cheltenham Festival in March is the big horse racing event in this country, and it's as much an Irish event as it is a British one.
Well, we hope that you will be able to go there without a mask and, I don't know.
All that and more, yes. But I mean, that's what's great about literature and all these books and stuff like that. You know, you can get taken away. And what's great about audiobooks is that they have sort of given people the escape that, because if you immerse yourself only in news, it only leads to anxiety, fear and depression. So people have recognized that. People who wouldn't necessarily have picked up books in their paper form have taken to audiobooks to listen to in the car, to listen to when they fed up with the news, to listen to maybe gardening if they got one on walks. And you can really escape, and like literate is best helps you to do. And so audiobooks have been booming as a result of the current pandemic.
Exactly. Well, and everybody, go out and get these It's a wonderful series. Everybody will love it. I think it's just, as you said, it's beyond, it's special kind of mysteries. And in this, I think this one is actually suspense. It's a wonderful book. You've done a beautiful job. And just, I'm so thrilled that I'm sure I'm going to get lots of nice emails from my listeners because you're fascinating. And maybe I could have you back on and you could maybe do, you can talk more Irish to me. I like Irish. Okay. And it's Louise Penny's All the Devils Are Here. And the title comes from The Tempest. And I got a Cambridge guy. I cannot tell you how thrilled I am for a little girl from the Michigan's Upper Peninsula. It means a lot to me.
I'm delighted. I'm glad to be of service.
Okay. Well, Robert Bathurst, you are fantastic. It was an absolute joy to talk to you today.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Love it.
Okay. Bye-bye now. Bye. Oh, isn't that fantastic? I love him. I love it. And the book is really good. Oh, wow. You know, if you haven't read this series, Louise Penny's series is wonderful. As we mentioned, it's set essentially in Quebec, in a very, very pretty little area. I know the area actually very, very well because we used to go fishing up at Blue Lake, Quebec, and I got some of the best trout ever. Now, I'm from Michigan. We have great trout, but the ones in Quebec, unbelievable, unbelievable. And there's a wonderful, wonderful series. So do check into that. And wow, the time just went. That's what happens, especially when I talk to a narrator and somebody who went to Cambridge. Oh, I just love this guy. I'm going to have him. I think I'm going to have him back on. I'll have him read something. I didn't have him read anything this time. And I'll have him back on just so I can tease him because so it just wasn't wonderful. I got him. I can't believe it. I knew the quote from The Tempest. That's wonderful. Okay, that's what it comes from reading a lot. That's what I do. I read a lot. And if you have a book, you know, you can contact me. Go to my webpage, radio-joy on paper. Send me a note right there on the front page. If you have a book you want me to read, let me know, and maybe you will be a guest here on Joy on Paper, because I'm always looking for, and although everybody's always sending me books, I'm always looking for a new great book, and so I was really thrilled today. It is hard to believe, I'm going to tell you, the book that the author I spoke to in the first part of the program, it is almost impossible to believe that it is her first book. It is so good. Rebecca de Harling, whoa, I don't know where she came out with that book. She just years of work all came in through her head. Anyway, remember what I always tell everyone. One of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken in an audible book, or if you're very, very lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture, streaming video, or perhaps a series on the Hallmark Channel, like I am hoping for Carol J. Perry's book, because, wow, she's got 11 books in her series, Witch City Mysteries, and she's ready for television, and I'm hoping that we can get her noticed by those people over there in Hollywood. Hey, Hollywood, if you're listening, and some of you are, I know you are, anyway, and I do want to say a special Kelly, if you're listening, this is for you. Please, please contact me. Anyway, everybody, say something nice to somebody today. I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Ed. I appreciate everything you do. And always, he sprayed this place with Clorox number 5, and I smell like this all day. He's saluting me. I'm saluting him. Bye-bye, everybody. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
WTAN Clearwater.
FM 106.1.
WDCF Dade City.
FM 102.3.
WZHR Zephyr Hills.
FM 104.3.
Listen.
AP News. I'm Ed Donahue. 9 drug companies are taking an unprecedented step. The AP Sagar Magani reports they are trying to boost public confidence in any approved coronavirus vaccine.
The firms include Merck, Pfizer, AstraZeneca, and others who'd be likely to produce the first virus vaccines. Amid worries, U.S. regulators will face political pressure to approve a vaccine before it's fully proven safe and effective. The company's top executives have signed a pledge.
All the companies are saying that we will only submit for authorization when we have evidence of safety and efficacy.
Pfizer CEO Albert Bourla telling NBC's Today show they will stand with science, sticking to the highest standards in testing and manufacturing. Sagar Magani, Washington.
White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows says President Trump is not trying to pressure regulators. Democrats, he says, are criticizing the president's optimism about the vaccine.
This is the political season. They're going to criticize anything that the president is involved with. I can tell you it's good science and good doctors and great companies that are actually working hand in glove to try to deliver something in record speed.